So I'm going to talk about plant breeding and creating new plants. And I want to start right off with this image, which is one of my favorite stories from the crazy history of plants. This is a grass from Mexico called teosinte. And this is the original corn. This is what the ear of corn looked like before humans, Native Americans, got crazy with it and started transforming it. So this little sprig of like six seeds is the original ear of corn. You can see the little brown threads hanging down. Those are the silks of the corn. It's pretty crazy that that was then transformed into the corn that we know today, this huge ear that not only is much bigger, obviously, than the original teosinte that the Native Americans started with, but has all this diversity of color, and there's popcorn and sweet corn and all these different crazy things. This, if you can see, is just a comparison of the actual seeds. I grew teosinte in my garden a few years ago because that's the kind of weird person I am, just out of curiosity. So you can see the teosinte seeds here on the left, which are much, much smaller than the corn seeds there on the right. So it's kind of insane to think that this tiny little grass could be transformed into the crop that basically feeds the world right now. Our agriculture is pretty much solely based on corn and so dependent on it. And what's even cooler to me about this is this was done by people who had never heard of a gene, never heard of a chromosome, probably didn't know really very accurately how plant genetics worked, but just by over generations and generations of growing this stuff, picking the individuals had the biggest seeds, the best flavors, the best characteristics, completely transformed it into an entirely new thing. So as soon as agriculture started, people started taking plants and turning them into crazy, new, interesting things. This is my other like all-time favorite story from the history of plant domestication. This is a plant called Brassica oleraceae. It grows wild around the Mediterranean, and this plant has it becomes like half the produce department at the grocery store is all derived from this one little plant. So the leaves of this plant, people selected forms that are tastier, less bitter, more tender, the hipster's favorite kale. So then from that very same plant, people selected forms where those leaves curl into a ball, and that's cabbage. There's also ornamental cabbage, which we grow, which is derived from the same plant, but has the pretty colors that we like to grow in our gardens to look at rather than to eat. The flower buds of the very same plant are broccoli. Another take on the flower buds of that same plant is cauliflower. We get to the crazy ones, Brussels sprouts. These are the swollen buds at the bases of the leaves, again, derived from that very same original little weedy plant. And then the most bizarre of all is the kohlrabi, which is the swollen stem, again, from that very same plant. So it really is, if you're at the grocery store, like a quarter of the produce department is all derived from this one very plant. And if you saw it growing in the wild, you wouldn't think it looks like much that you'd want to eat, and you really wouldn't have much good eating out of it. But again, this is very early in human history, very early in agriculture. People were growing this, eating it, saying, oh, this tastes better. Oh, this is a cool shape. Oh, there's more flower buds than this one. And they selected those and bred those and changed them over generation to generation. And really, just about everything we eat has been transformed almost unrecognizably from its original forms. Some of the fruit, you would recognize the ancestors, because mostly we just made fruit bigger. But the vegetables, the grains, all this, you know, the roots and things we eat are radically different than the plants that we started with. So I'm endlessly fascinated by this process. I think it's really cool just to think about the ways that people who didn't know much about, you know, science as we have it today were able to create these amazing things that we depend on. But I'm the kind of person that once I learn that something cool can be done, I don't want to just learn about how other people do it. I want to do it myself. So I like to play with breeding plants and changing plants myself in my garden. And I get into these crazy ideas and start doing bizarre things in my garden. So a few years ago, I had this brilliant idea that didn't quite work out, but it was so smart when I came up with it. I thought, I was living in Lansing at the time, and I thought, what if I could get an ear of corn that had green and white seeds on the same ear of corn? I could take this to a farmer's market in East Lansing, have MSU colors on an ear of corn. I could clean up. I couldn't care less about football. I kind of know football's the one that has the pointy ends on the sides. That's all I know about football. But I do know that people in East Lansing care about their Spartans. And if I had Spartan corn, I could sell it for as much as I wanted. So my idea was to take this variety of green corn called Oaxacan green and try to cross it with a white corn and see if I could get corn that had the green and white kernels intermixed. That was my brilliant idea. it didn't quite work out the way I had hoped. It turns out you get the green color in corn if you have a gene for a yellow pigment and a gene for a blue pigment expressed at the same time. It's just like mixing paints, yellow and blue, you get green. When you cross it with something else, those colors, those genes become disassociated, and you do get green and white kernels, and you also get yellow and blue kernels, which not quite so marketable in East Lansing. So this brilliant idea turned out I had the state's football rivalry all wrapped up in one ear of corn. Not quite what I had in mind. But the fun thing about playing with breeding plants is out of these failures comes unexpected opportunities. So on some of these ears, I was noticing some of the kernels had this really fat, cool, sort of pale iridescent blue color that I thought was really pretty. And the cool thing about corn, one of the many cool things about corn, is that the color of the individual kernel of corn is determined by the genetics of that individual seed. So if you're a gardener, you know that tomato seeds all look the same. You can plant, looking at the seed, you can't tell if it's going to be a cherry tomato or a big beefsteak tomato. All the seeds look the same. But with corn, if the seed is blue, it's going to produce a plant that has blue ears. And if the seed is red, it's going to produce red ears, and so on. So if you find cool colors of corn, you can pick them out, grow them together, and you get all, so that's what I did. I picked out these very pale, bluey, pinky colors and got these interesting iridescent, pale, sort of mother of pearly corn, which I thought was really pretty. And that set me off now not thinking of trying to sell these at the farmer's market in East Lansing, but just exploring all the crazy, fun things I could do with different colors of corn. So I started just collecting different weird colors of corn, planting them, selecting them. I crossed in popcorns, which give them that really glossy, shiny look to the kernels. When fall comes and they have the big bins of ornamental corn for sale at, you know, the grocery stores, I was always rooting through those bins, searching over each ear, looking for just the one kernel that had just the right color that I wanted to take home and add to my breeding project. It got pretty insane, but it was really, really fun. And I kept, it got bigger and bigger and more unwieldy as I kept doing this. So I got fun colors out of it. Some sort of weird, unexpected things always pop up. This one, I was like, oh, it's so pretty. And a friend was like, doesn't that look like nipples? I'm like, yeah, it kind of does. But unfortunately, this was very unstable. I couldn't get it to do it predictably. The color is dependent on temperature, so it wasn't. I was like, oh, it would be great if I could get this to do it every year, but I never could quite get that to work out. Then I started picking out the very darkest ones and breeding them together to get this corn that's almost black, which was really fun. So they're obviously pretty, and you can use them for fall decoration and stuff. Then the question is always, are these edible? So these are not sweet corns. You wouldn't eat them like corn on the cob, because these pigments don't develop at the stage when the sweet corn is ready. They only develop later in the corn's maturity. But you can grind them up into cornmeal and make cornbread out of them, and that gets really fun when you start using these crazy colors. So you can use a coffee grinder. If you have whole corn, coffee grinder works great. My poor husband has to deal with the fact that there's corn in his coffee grinder when he goes to make his coffee in the morning, but, you know, he has to deal with a lot of crazy things. So if you take your black corn, you grind it into cornmeal and make cornbread, it makes cornbread that looks like brownies. It's pretty cool. It doesn't taste like brownies, unfortunately, but it's pretty crazy. The colors come through at, in the baking process and the corn and the products you make out of this corn. And the flavor is really actually good and interesting. And the more I explored this, it turns out that in the Native American cultures, they didn't have just one kind of corn. We just have sort of generic white corn or yellow corn mostly. They had lots of different varieties that were intended for specific uses, had specific flavors, and a lot of that diversity and sort of that tradition of how to use the different corns in cooking has been pretty much lost. So I would love to someday, when I had more time, really get into exploring the flavors of this and sort of, I think, you know, in the foodie movement, there's a lot of room to find crazy, interesting flavors and forms in all the diversity of corn. So corn's a lot of fun, and one of the many things that I am obsessed with breeding and playing with in my garden. I do a lot of flowers. I'm a flower person. These are gladiolus, which is another plant that I love to breed. It's getting like thousands of new ones each year right now, which is kind of crazy, but I have a lot of fun with it. And then there's tomatoes. I was just talking before we got started with one of our other speakers, who was talking about the fact that people get obsessed with tomatoes. I don't know if you know this, but tomatoes, of all the vegetables, there's the most people obsessed with them, deeply and profoundly. And there's a lot of fun. There's a lot of fun things about tomatoes. If you're into food at all or gardening at all, you've surely heard about heirloom tomatoes, these old varieties that have interesting colors, great flavors, sort of unusual, sometimes strange forms, like you see there in the middle, which are in stark contrast to sort of some of the modern commercial varieties, which are perfectly round and red and hard and tasteless. So there's been a big movement to sort of rediscover these old varieties. And these heirloom varieties were created sort of by, you know, small farmers and gardeners who, again, were selecting forms that tasted best, that performed really well from the garden, that they really liked. And so they have a lot of those traits that people like in their gardeners because they're created by gardeners, essentially. In contrast to some of these newer varieties, which are produced by more corporate entities with, you know, interest in things like high yield and shipping and how long they're going to last on the grocery store shelf and those things which weren't really on the minds of early gardeners. So I love that there's the whole movement to sort of rediscover and preserve these old heirloom varieties of tomatoes. And there's also a lot of people who are then saying, well, we have these tomatoes. We don't have to stop with just saving the heirlooms. What if we start breeding new heirlooms, if you will, playing with these things, trying to create new flavors, new textures, new colors? And it gets to be a lot of fun. So this is a project I did, it's probably quite a few years ago now. So I took these two different varieties of tomatoes. So this is Black Crème, which is a wonderful Eastern European variety that I'm obsessed with. And then this is a cherry tomato called Matt's Wild Cherry, which is also really delicious, really, really different. So you take these two varieties, hybridize them, aka make them have sex, and then, whoops, then this is what you get. So this is, each of these tomatoes on the screen is from grown from a different plant produced from hybridizing those two different varieties. So when you breed them together, their genes and traits get mixed up together and you get all this diversity ranging from little tiny cherry tomatoes to big tomatoes, weird black tomatoes like the Black Crème, all the different colors. And of course, what you can't see here on the screen is that there's a ton of diversity in flavor. They're sweet and some are tart and some are, you know, really savory. Some of them taste really foul, actually. There's lots of gross flavors tomatoes can do that you've never tasted because some plant breeder tastes like, oh no, and threw that out of the breeding population. So it's really, really fun to sort of have these things, to get to taste through them, to find the ones that you like best. When I grew this particular population, I had several different friends of mine taste them, and everybody had a different favorite. Everybody likes different things, so it's really fun to sort of explore and play with the diversity that comes out of breeding these crops. And what's really been interesting in recent years is sort of this, you know, as I said, breeding plants has been going on forever, basically since agriculture began. And there's people like me who are always crazy and like to play with these things and breed them at home. But there's been some interesting movements that are really cool where people are taking sort of very modern tools of the internet, crowdsourcing big collaborative projects to sort of breed interesting, cool new plants. And one of my favorite ones is this thing called the Dwarf Tomato Project. If you're interested, dwarftomatoproject.net has all the information about it. And this is this crazy project that started on a website called Tomatoville. So this is, if you love tomatoes, you need to go to Tomatoville. It's a website of multiple different message boards, whole bunches of message boards, just for people who are obsessed, deeply, profoundly obsessed with tomatoes. So if you're a tomato lover, that's your home right there on the web. And this project started on Tomatoville to try to breed new tomatoes in this big group collaborative way. And what they wanted to breed was a different growth habit. So how many people are people gardeners at all in here? A handful. Well, if you've grown tomatoes, you may know that there's different growth habits. Indeterminate tomatoes, which make these huge, old, big, sprawly vines that you have to stake and get everywhere, but produce a lot of tomatoes over the course of the summer. Determinate tomatoes are smaller and more compact, which is nice if you have a small garden, but they usually have been bred to produce sort of one big flush of tomatoes, and they're mostly commercial varieties. They've been bred so you can come through with a team of people and pick your crop all at once. And neither of them are really great sort of for, I would say, the modern garden, which is often really small, or a container on a patio. The old varieties are too huge, and the determinants don't produce over a long enough period of time. So there's a third type called the dwarf tomato, which is small and compact, so it fits well in a small space, or if you're like me and you're too lazy to stake your tomatoes, makes a nice little tidy mound, but produces tomatoes over a long period of time. And there used to be only, excuse me, one or two of these dwarf tomato varieties. So these people on Tomatoville said, we need to make more dwarf tomatoes. And that's what they did. So this is one of their tastings that they hold every year. They created this whole host of all the colors and flavors and crazy shapes we associate with heirloom tomatoes in this wonderful dwarf growth habit. And it's a collaborative project. They post a call in the spring on Tomatoville. Anybody who wants to grow out the seeds, they send seeds all over the country. People grow them out in their gardens. Everybody tastes them, finds the ones that are best, that have the best flavor, that grow the best. And then send them back to the organizers. So by leveraging the internet and sort of bringing in the whole crowd, they're able to grow out thousands and thousands of these tomatoes rather than just, you know, the dozen you might be able to do at home and really produce great varieties. Then the cool thing is one of the organizers lives in Australia. So in our winter, the seeds go to Australia and they get another generation during their summer. So they can do it twice as fast by shipping them back and forth through this giant international collaborative breeding project. So it's really fascinating to me to go from, like, you know, all the way to Native Americans taking teosinte and breeding it to corn, to people today online getting big crowdsourced projects to breed new tomato varieties. So I hope that this has helped you. Next time you're in the grocery store, you'll look at the produce with a little different eye, appreciating the stories of what's going on. And maybe, just maybe, I've inspired you to explore a little bit about the crazy fun of making new plants yourselves. So thank you very much.